Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, July 16th, 2011. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic this week is Showdown Time, Glass-Steagall or Die. Now, what we refer to, and I'm sure many of our regulars know full well, is that we are at a momentous decision point for civilization, for the nation of the United States, for the world, for the direction we're going to go in. And we'll say more about that in a second, but I'm very glad that we have two guests, not just from the transatlantic, but from the Pacific Rim. I want to welcome first from Seattle, Dave Christie. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks, Marcia.
And Dave, you know, is one of the slate of six candidates, LaRouche Democratic candidates for Congress, who's leading the policy fight in the United States for reinstating Glass-Steagall, for, of course, he's in the land that would be developed in the key project to launch on our continent, the North American water and power lines, many other things. But it's also, he is leading the charge on the slate for the policy fight internationally. And with that in on the Atlantic side, in Italy, speaking to us from Milan, we're glad to welcome Andrew Spanis. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you. Good to be here. Hello.
Good. And he may say more about this, but Andrew is an officer. I think you're the secretary, I believe, of the Italian LaRouche co-thinker organization, the Movimento Solidarietà, right?
That is correct.
And
I'm the national secretary.
And they have been more active not only in Italy but at large, and we're looking forward, by the way, to having Liliana Guarini, who's the chairman of that, to be on sometime in the coming weeks. And I just want to say right at the beginning here that, Andrew, I think you were in attendance at a very important conference of the Schiller Institute internationally in Germany, July 2nd and 3rd. Is that right?
Yes, I was at the conference, the weekend conference.
Okay.
Held by the Schiller Institute, yes, in Germany, in Rüsselsheim, near Frankfurt.
And we, Mr. LaRouche gave keynotes there, but the latest EIR online features key statements made at that conference, and by, I think the general title is Rescuing Civilization from the Brink, and that's really what we're talking about here today, that Italy's come into the forefront in the showdown, and Andrew will say more about it, but about 10 days ago, on one level, what you had is the most blatant thing where a bunch of hedge fund vulture types had a confab, staged a run on Italian state bonds and other paper in Italy. And then the finance minister of Italy, Mr. Tremonti, stood up to all of this. That's good in its own right. But it's also a marker of the showdown nature of the time in which we're fighting right now, that you here in the United States, on this side of the Atlantic, you have the endless discussion on what to do about the debt ceiling, who's going to blink, how much can we cut, the president wants to axe all social programs, and so you got all this. In Europe, you have likewise blab going on of all kinds about different nations, about basically unpayable, unworthy, illegitimate debt, and really bailouts for these bankrupt financial, for banks and so forth associated with the kind of modern-day British imperial system that should be buried, not bailed out. So we're at a point where we need bankruptcy reorganization. We need it now. We need the Glass-Steagall implemented, reinstated in the United States, and a break with this bailout disease. I will point out that I'm not trying to recount all of the developments of the week, but we did have the head of the Federal Reserve moot again this week to Congress in the House and the Senate that we should have another bailout. He used some expressions. He didn't say quantitative easing 3, QE3. He said maybe something like asset enhancement or... But the point about all of this is none of this is the topic. We don't want to get sucked into it. And in fact, Mr. LaRouche, who's back in the United States, did a special interview in the last 48 hours. I encourage everyone to look at and spread around to your friends and enemies, saying that don't get sucked into this kind of false issue. What we need to do is have this radical policy shift. And I want to, well, let me just describe. He was interviewed by Alicia Serratani, and it's only a 17-minute video in which is advertised on the LaRouche Political Action Committee website as saying the latest run on Italian state bonds and the downgrading of the bonds of Greece and Ireland have actually signaled the final days of the transatlantic monetary system. The problem is that cowards on both sides of the Atlantic are falling for the bait, and they are continuing to try to bail these bastards out at the expense of the lives of ordinary people. That must change, and change soon. Mankind is far too precious. So I think that sums up our orientation for our discussion, and with just one thing I want to repeat during the show, Mr. LaRouche's next special appearance is going to be an international webcast July 21st on Thursday. That's 1 p.m. Eastern Time. You'll see the particulars of that on our EIR online website. That's LaRouchePub.com, where many of you are listening to the Today Show on. But keep that in mind. And with that, let's go to where to Andrew in Italy. If you want to give a situation report on just on the facts of the your view of the relevant facts of the matter of how nations in the civilization is on the brink of either disaster or breakthrough.
Well, we are in a situation in particular in Europe where it is absolutely clear that the current system, especially the European part of the monetary system, the euro system, you know, the single currency, is absolutely doomed to fail in the short term. It's already failing. And the what has happened is in the past 20 years, essentially, while in the United States you've had a continuance and a much deeper destruction of the real physical economy, you've had the same thing going on here in Europe. However, it's been a little bit slower. But one of the key things that was done to move this process forward was to remove economic sovereignty from the hands of governments. And what this has done is this has created a situation where, in the face of this crisis, where the financial system is falling apart and is shown to be, you know, absolutely incapable of guaranteeing minimum conditions of life for people, what has happened is that no one is able to react. No one is able to take action to actually change the situation because they have decided to pray to the god of the free market and of the monetary authorities. And it's very clear that if this structure of the European Union, the way it is currently organized, is not taken down, then there is no hope for the nations of Europe right now.
I understand just in the last couple days, or maybe it was today, well, I mean Friday, I forgot to say, by the way, we had to pre-tape the show for technical reasons this week. I meant to say at the beginning, but so we have taped the July 16th on July 15th. But, Andrew, the Parliament voted, and maybe what I heard was one of the fastest votes ever, to have an austerity program to just continue to serve this myth of this Eurozone?
Absolutely. In Italy, things normally take a long time. What happens, the way it normally works is the government announces their budget, and for a few weeks people argue about it, then they bring it to the parliament, and then the parliament argues about it for a while, and then by the end of the year, usually about December 30th or so, they approve it. So it takes months and months, usually, to do this. What's happened this time is that there was a concerted attack, as you mentioned, Marcia, planned and organized by a number of important hedge funds, important because they hold a lot of money, not important because they do anything positive for people, who decided that it was time to attack Italy's public debt, Italy's state bonds, because Italy has a large public debt, 120% of its GDP, which it has built up over the past 30 years. And what this means is that half of this public debt, about half of it, is held by foreign banks or foreign funds. So if someone decides that they're going to start putting pressure on this You know, in Italy, they can just start short selling these bonds, meaning that they start speculating, betting that the price of these are going to go down and making it harder for Italy to finance its public debt. And it was a decision made not because of some real change in the Italian economy in the last 2 months or 2 weeks. What happened is the decision was made to take out the next target. And Italy is much bigger than the economy of Greece or Ireland or even Spain. So what happened is this has put pressure, and we can go into this a little bit more about how this has worked specifically later. It has put pressure on Italy to immediately toe the line of massive austerity. And whereas there has been a fight over this in Italy, there's been significant resistance to this in Italy over the past few years during the financial crisis. Italy did not bail out its banks. One of the only countries which did not give any money to its banks during the financial crisis. And what happened now is even the best people in Italy immediately got into line saying, okay, we'll double the austerity package up to over $100 billion, you know, 70 billion euros, considering an economy much smaller than the United States. And it was passed in 2 days, in 2 days with essentially no debate. And the biggest problem is with essentially no one in the political class who had the political institutions who had the courage to go against it, because it's a blackmail against the country. The country is told that either you do what's demanded of you, and you open up your economy to looting, further looting, or you're going to be wiped out. You're going to end up like Greece, where you have foreign banks coming in to buy up your monuments, you know, and anything else you might have sitting around your house, which we might want.
And what's the nature of these cuts? Could you just describe a little to people here?
Yes, the cuts are across the board cuts. For example, the pension system. People are going to have to retire later. You know, these are things which are phased in, but within a few years, people will be retiring 3 months later. It will take, and then it will go up to 5 months later, to 6 months later. So even when you reach your retirement age, it will take longer. There are tax increases across the board in the sense that they are removing a series of tax deductions, all sorts of tax deductions, interest on mortgages, deductions for having dependent children, for having a family. They added an extra cost, an extra copay to all specialist visits and all hospital exams, and also outpatient exams. Now, so this is a cost which it's $15 or something, but it's added on to what already exists. So these are cuts which go across the board, hit everybody. Mm-hmm. And the idea is you have to give us the money right away. We want the money. Mm-hmm. But the bigger thing that they're all pushing for, though, people who are the emanation and the expression of Wall Street and the City of London, is to open up the economy, the parts of the economy that are still productive, that are still influenced by state policy, and that are not part of the financial market yet. They want that loot.
Right, and as you speak, we hear the same, we translate it into Americanese, and that's what Obama and others in Washington have been proposing in recent days, right, Dave?
Oh, yes.
And, well, Andrew, butt in at any time, but Dave, I was thinking one thing is, we want to hear from you the momentum and the need for still more momentum, an update from you. But you're in the state of Washington. You have Oregon nearby, Idaho, Montana. But you, what Andrew was describing about in Italy was timed at the same time as the beginning of the new fiscal year for all our states, right?
Right, exactly.
And I was just checking, knowing you would be on, I just tuned into a Seattle TV show today. And what did they announce? That they're already in their new fiscal year, but they have 22 million less in revenue than they thought they were going to have this year.
Yep.
and of course, you, a 2-year budget was agreed to or something like that, which had $4.5 billion of cuts out of a 32 billion 2-year budget. So can you just describe the situation you've got on your hands?
Well, you know, I do think, going back to what LaRouche had said, that coming into the middle of July, he had identified around the 10th or so, where he said that given the fact that the states will have to reckon their budgets, we can expect, this as a new inflection point in the collapse. And, you know, I think it was the 11th when the situation broke out in Europe and so forth. So, you know, it really is a disintegration of the entire international financial system. This is, as this thing disintegrates, to maintain the values of the financial oligarchy, they're demanding the blood of the population. You know, as Obama announced with the cuts to, he says, we have to put everything on the table, including Social Security and Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's, all of the states are bankrupt. I think North Dakota somehow managed to make it out. But and as you mentioned, we have the $4 billion in cuts here, or $4.5 billion, which is going to be, it's already beginning to hit in the form of cuts to, you know, police, fire, Medicaid will be, of course, the big one, which is what Obama said, that, you know, it's okay for the states to offload their Medicaid responsibilities, which is really part of this whole health care fiasco that he had done, saying that, you know, we'll get everybody into private insurance, but that will be done through cuts to services, Medicare and so forth, you know. So yes, it's all part of the same package. It's an international collapse, and we're not isolated over here on the other side of the mountains.
Right. Well, why don't we go ahead, unless you want to draw out some, we can get back to this, but why don't you describe some, in one of your videos on LaRouche Political Action Committee, people can go and look, I think the one in May, where you were at a street rally and said, it's Glass-Steagall or die, and you're going to insist on momentum. And you've had action. Do you want to update us on some of this?
Sure. You know, we had a really, as part of the national slate that, you know, LaRouche had formed this slate coming out of the absolute disaster of the 2010 elections in November, where the country revolted against Obama and the Democrats, who had really continued the same policy of Bush and Cheney, and in fact escalated it to a new degree, showing that Obama was of a complete agent of this international financial group, the British Empire, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had this backlash against Obama and voted in some of the worst budget-cutting fascist Republicans you could imagine. And it was here that LaRouche, you know, said we formed this national slate to bring the country back to sanity. And you know, as this has gone on, we've made the point, as the slate, and LaRouche has made this as well, that, you know, the party system is dying. The idea of the club, you know, your special either red or blue club team that you're on, is disintegrating, and the population wants to hear a solution that will actually work. You know, I think, just touching on it, but this mass strike phenomena is that people will seek that which they know is not of the axioms that have brought their society to collapse. And so what we found is, you know, going into, particularly, we decided to focus in because of obviously the demographics here. There's a very large and active Democratic Party base here.
Mm-hmm.
We have also a number of congressmen that have expressed support of Glass-Steagall. Jay Inslee had signed on to Hinchey's bill from last year. Of course, we had Maria Cantwell, who had teamed up with John McCain in 2009 to put forward an amendment into the Dodd-Frank bill in 2009 to return to Glass-Steagall. So there's a moment. There was a certain history here of people oriented to Glass-Steagall. And what we had done is gone into the various legislative district meetings, which, the way Washington works, it's chunked up into about 50 legislative districts. Actually, I think it's 49. And each of those districts is somewhere around 130,000 people. May have the numbers not exactly right. So each one of these districts has a Democratic Party club, and obviously they have Republican Party clubs as well. And so we went into the meetings with an idea that we were going to get a resolution passed endorsing Glass-Steagall on the spot, which actually requires, in pretty much all of the cases, a suspension of the rules. And so just going in there and saying, look, we don't care about your rules. We don't care about the rigmarole of having to wait till next month. We need this passed now. We've got to keep this momentum that's been building that the rest of the slate had been, you know, working on. Obviously, things like the AFL-CIO of New Jersey having passed a resolution endorsing Glass-Steagall, various other endorsements, coming from around the nation.
Right.
And so going into these legislative district meetings, we said, we're going to move this through now. And in the whole process of the month, May and part of June, none of the legislative district meetings ended up passing a resolution, but the King County Democrats, which ends up being kind of the, I guess you could say, the mothership of all these smaller legislative districts.
That's Seattle, meaning Seattle?
Yeah, Seattle, uh-huh. Bellevue. It's approximately close to 2 million people in the mm-hmm. entirety of King County. I think it's one of the largest counties in the nation. And so they ended up passing a resolution, and now since then we've been getting the smaller legislative districts to as well move on it. And there is momentum as well. You know, some of this we have yet to actually see the final endorsements, but various labor organizations have expressed that they are moving on some sort of a Glass-Steagall resolution. This is really then part of the overall national mobilization that we're seeing within labor. Of course, as people listening to the show probably know, the International Aerospace Machinists have endorsed Glass-Steagall. Obviously, out here, the aerospace industry is large with Boeing here. We have the National Farmers Union, various of the smaller AFL-CIOs, including the state AFL-CIO of New Jersey, and then, of course, the different city councils all across the nation, really. So that's been some of the momentum, and we just need to keep escalating and getting it moving at an even faster rate.
Yeah, let me throw in here, Dave, because people should know the full list of co-sponsors is being kept up, and you can get it right on the homepage of LaRouchePAC.com. I think it's maybe about 27, but of course, as you just indicated, this isn't a question, you know, every day, another way, another person. We're not doing it incrementally. There's a building momentum. In the last few days, the state of Kentucky AFL-CIO passed a resolution, Dave.
Oh, okay.
So along with New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And the additional signers, there's another Republican who signed this, Rodney Alexander, who's from the 5th Congressional District of Louisiana. And people who listen to our discussion regularly on LaRouche Show know that Fred Unifeld, who was on here some months ago, that's his particular home district, and I think Mr. Alexander had no choice if he was ever going to go back home again. But Raul Grijalva, the head of the Progressive Caucus, has signed it. And, of course, what characterizes this momentum is that you might have, the Republican, I think his name is Mr. Kaufman from Colorado, is head of the Balanced Budget Caucus. You're getting everything else, but this situation is intolerable to both have the degree of collapse we have and yet at the same time to have the false issues discussed of the debt ceiling or the, you know, what LaRouche saying, let's preempt it right now. This has got to stop. We have to have the bankruptcy reorganization and new credit system.
We can't. Marcia, could I jump in on this?
Go right ahead. That's all I had, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, from especially the view from Europe, and in particular in Italy, on why this is so important, this mobilization in the United States for Glass-Steagall is so important. I can tell you my personal experience in organizing politicians here in Italy in the past few years makes it very clear how important this is, because during the blowout of the financial system 2007, 2008, 2009, what happened is that in Italy, a number of people, high-level people, including the economics minister, you know, Tremonti, came out very publicly calling for a new Bretton Woods-style reorganization of the global financial and monetary system, some of them associating it directly with the name of Lyndon LaRouche. But in many cases, both in resolutions introduced in the Senate, in the Chamber of Deputies, which is the equivalent of the House of Representatives, saying this needs to be done to save the global economy. We have to go back to a fixed exchange rate system. We have to separate the financial speculation from the real economy. We have to save the real economy and let the, you know, let the banks fail, who are the banks who are the speculative banks, the investment banks, and keep the commercial banks operating to save the economy. And we know, and I know personally, that this proposal, the proposals of the LaRouche movement, were taken to the highest level in the G20 meetings, in the international, you know, the various international conferences, where people in Italy, some people from Italy, brought this up. Now, what happened? What we all know happened is that in the United States, this was not the direction taken. The Obama administration emphatically did not go in this direction and decided to stick with the bailout policy, obviously. And so this is why it's so important to have this fight in the United States, because in Europe, if there is a change in the United States in this direction, then the best people in Europe will immediately be ready to change, right? Because what people think here is they get into a mental, you know, this mental cage of saying we cannot make a change because the most important countries, right, aren't making that change. So they're stuck into this rut of saying we have to follow the orders that come from London, that come from Wall Street, and now that come from Brussels, from the European Union bureaucracy, right? So this is a shift in the United States would immediately transform the situation over here as well.
Mm-hmm. Actually, just to add to that, Andrew, in the organizing here, as LaRouche has laid out this idea of the club or the party rules, which really is the way in which, well, number one, that's why Obama is still around. If it weren't for the club rules, he would have been thrown out by now for his various, violations of the Constitution, the War Powers Act, even just the issue that he's saying that he may intervene on the debt ceiling as an executive, so on and so forth. But in our organizing, especially saying to these people, look, it's not about your club. This is not about the Democratic Party. This is not about the Republican Party, or even in terms of labor organizers, that, you know, a lot of these groups think that they're supportive of Glass-Steagall and often get into this trap of thinking that it's from their own particular advantage, you know, to their own advantage, to whatever club or organization they may be a part of. And what we have just been very clear on is that, one, this is not just a national fight, right? You're not just to think as a national leader, but really think as an international leader. That's what's needed from people. And then, of course, you know, I think we have some of our team in the basement, which is even thinking galactically and beyond, but you know, really, that's, we have to get people elevated to the highest mindset that there's no localized solutions to any of this. This is the question of Glass-Steagall has the immediate implications for the crisis of Europe, connected to this new Bretton Woods policy.
All right. Well, let me ask just another thing, Andrew. I don't know if you have time to be observing this closely, some of the shenanigans in Washington. It isn't really worth it. But
yes, I do.
Yeah, okay.
I follow it very closely.
But you must feel, there you are dealing with, living in a situation with the European parliamentary system playing out, as you've been talking about. And here we have a knockoff variety in Washington where leaders behind the scenes, as you often see in the London parliamentary, the mother of parliamentary systems, where you just get a few leaders meeting in secret and then you get Obama storming out and then you get this and that, as opposed to an actual policy debate, which is not debate, but, you know, having real terms set of reality in which to discuss things. So do you must see that starkly? You see that dramatized here? We've had that, especially in the last few weeks.
Yes, I see. What I see is the situation where the policy is decided beforehand,
mm-hmm.
and the policy is decided not by the public representatives. It's decided elsewhere, and then your political representatives are called on simply to ratify it, you know, and execute it. This is what happens here in the parliamentary system. We have, you know, Italy has a parliament which, in which it's very easy to bring down the government. The government, you know, the executive has to have confidence, has to have a majority in the parliament, in both houses of parliament. So any time that there's a government which has a small majority, what can happen is if five or six, you know, congressmen decide, well, we're going to, you know, we disagree on something, and they vote against the government, then the government falls, and you have to get a new government. And then you either get an unelected government after that, or you get or you have to go to new elections. So it's impossible to get things done often in this way. But the what's always very clear is that policy is made at a higher level, unfortunately, and people, therefore, anyone who gets out of line over here is easily dealt with in this way, and a government which gets out of line is easily dealt with. With the European Union, we see it even more clearly at the international, you know, supranational level now, because the European Union basically already makes close to 90% of the laws
uh-huh.
of legislation in terms of economics in Europe for mm-hmm. any European member countries. And in the past, the former Prime Minister of Italy, Prodi, already more than 5 years ago said it's already 80%. You know, now we've got the Lisbon Treaty, which is even more, you know, takes, you know, removes what little is left of sovereignty for countries up to the European level. And at the European level, it's not the European Parliament that makes decisions. The decisions are made very clearly by the European Commission, an unelected body,
yeah.
which introduces the laws, and then the Parliament is called on as the last step to vote up or down. Right? So, and most of the laws are actually put out as directives, not even as laws which are voted on by the Parliament. So you have this situation. Now, and I see this parallel very clearly in the United States. You have what comes out, especially in the media. You know, if someone watches the major, you know, the major news media on TV, or you read the major newspapers, there's a debate which is all about who's going to cut more. You know, where are we going to cut? How much are we going to cut? Are we going to totally eliminate Medicare? Are we just going to cut it halfway? Right? And what you're not getting is what the real fight is. That is the fight for the alternative, the fight for Glass-Steagall. The media doesn't tell you about that. Yet, you know, as Dave was describing to us, there's a huge fight around this, and as Marsha, as you were saying also, with the various people who are endorsing this, but that doesn't come out. And so we see this, you know, this political theater where you have these leaders who are, you know, discussing about how to save the country by destroying it, whereas the real fight is actually what's going on by people who are mobilizing, you know, in their communities, putting pressure on their representatives, and also putting pressure on the national political institutions to get real.
Right. Well, Dave, in that regard, let me ask you, because the discussion with people, you described the venue of these actual legislative district Democratic Party groupings, labor, and so forth, you scientists and all, and in past months, you personally and the whole effort in the West was very involved in organizing among engineers and others for the North American Water and Power Alliance, and also this overlaps organizing for true security in our galaxy, because you're in the you're in a very active earthquake zone on our planet, right?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we have the Rim of Fire, the Pacific Rim of Fire is very active right now with, I think, in Indonesia, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Over the last recent period, there are not an earthquake. I meant volcano, I think.
Right.
Yeah, I misspoke. But go ahead. In the discussions with people, the uptake is faster, or you found anything you want to say about a reading on the mood of people?
Concerning the seismic and so forth?
Yeah, well, I was mostly thinking of the layers of people that you had been contacting over time dealing with the hardcore physical economy.
Yeah. Well, you know, Washington State itself is, you have quite a diverse viewpoint, maybe. You know, you have the Hanford nuclear facility here.
Right.
You have, of course, really the core of a greenie ideology, especially on this side of the Cascade Mountains, in terms of the sort of liberal, you know, mindset or how you want to put it.
Yeah, you're world famous, I think, for that.
yeah. But, you know, we had done a lot of outreach to the various different layers. I had, you know, done a certain amount of work talking to different people in the nuclear community, obviously with Idaho, which is going to be really the central feature of NWAPA. This is going to be really, in terms of the pumping facilities out there, would require nuclear power, but probably a good core of the labor base would be coming from the Puget Sound area, and different, I would imagine Boeing would play its own unique role in that. So I think, you know, what we're seeing now is, you know, in the mobilization of that, of getting the different scientific and engineering circles familiar with what NWAPA is actually some of these guys that we're calling on in terms of Glass-Steagall as well.
Yeah, that's what I mean, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in the sense that, you know, Glass-Steagall would give us the foundation of a return to the Hamiltonian credit policy so that we can be in control of our own finances, which, of course, gives us control of how we actually develop the physical economy. And we could begin to deal with, you know, obviously NWAPA would be the core feature of a physical economic recovery, a new deal, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, dealing as well with this seismic threat. And I can tell you, that is on people's minds.
Okay.
Out here, you just bring it up, and the most people know that we have that Cascadia subduction zone sitting off our coast. It goes off every, I believe, 300 or 600 million years, or, and I'm sorry, 600 years.
Mm-hmm.
That is set to go any moment now. Actually, it's 300 years. And so people know that that's, on the verge of going through. We just had, obviously, up in the Aleutian Islands of Alaska,
yeah,
there was a 7.2 not too long ago.
Yeah.
So it is on people's minds. In fact, some of the people involved in labor, and especially around the various ports, the Port of Seattle and the Port of Tacoma, they are working on preparedness plans in the event of a tsunami or an earthquake. So this also, in the Glass-Steagall fight, is the return to the credit policy, which would actually give us the capability of, being able to generate the credit for the economic activity, the economic recovery that would be able to deal with the seismic threat in terms of retrograding buildings, upgrading the port, of course, and then the more advanced conceptions of getting the necessary satellites and precursor data collection, and having people really dive into this question of forecasting these seismic events.
Do you want to say something about Andrew? Because you're, just to be simple-minded about it, the Mediterranean is one of the active zones of the planet as well. But do people make in the organizing you do and outreach and so forth, make some of the new inferences and connections in terms of axioms of needing a credit system?
Well, the what they've said about the Glass-Steagall fight being the equivalent, and that being the same thing as the fight to rebuild the physical economy to allow us to survive,
mm-hmm,
what otherwise are called natural disasters, is emphatically true here also, although on a somewhat different scale. Now,
mm-hmm,
Italy is a very old place, as you know, in terms of population, in terms of culture and civilization. So the seismic activity here in Italy is a very seismic area, and there are a significant number of earthquakes here, but they're much smaller in terms of scale than what you get in the United States. Here, even an earthquake that's 5 or 6 on the Richter scale scale, though, is enough to level an old city, because these are often cities which have, you know, or towns which have buildings that are 600 years old, mm-hmm. 700 years old. So the you know, often there's a there was an earthquake a few years ago in Aquila. Mm-hmm. No, L'Aquila. There's earthquakes which have a you know, serious effects here, and the there are people here. Various people we're in touch with, and I think you can find some things on the website about Professor Bianchi in terms of dealing with the this whole question, which we presented of how to you know, predict the type of activity which leads to earthquakes. Now, but to bring it back to the economic point, what's not done here, you know, both in terms of rebuilding the infrastructure necessary, preparedness for natural disasters, but also the infrastructure, the general infrastructure which is needed for the population, is you have an economic situation where it's impossible to invest. Investments are not, you know, are so limited by this budget, you know, the budget situation. And the budget situation, though, is contrived, mm-hmm. in the sense that on the one hand, it's true that as the physical economy falls apart, there's less tax income, you know, for the government. There's a smaller tax base. But the government, by cutting the budget even more, makes the situation even worse. However, there are the rules of the European Union say you have to have, you know, you cannot have a deficit more than 3% of your GDP, right? Now, in Italy, people are talking about a balanced budget amendment. And what this means is that there's, you know, where do you find the money to actually build the infrastructure which will drive economic growth? Because they're saying, well, we'll have the money after the growth comes, you know, after the growth comes, after we do free market reforms to bring around growth. Mm-hmm. And obviously, those free market reforms are destroying the economy, so there never will be growth that way. So you have a situation where Italy could lead a number of projects, both for Italy but also for North Africa, and for Central Africa. There's this proposal to the Trans-Aqua project was presented by Vicky, Marcello Vicky, at the conference, which you mentioned at the beginning of the show, Marcia.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He presented the Trans-Aqua project.
And that originated, he's from Rome, or the group used to be in Rome, right?
Yeah, he's actually from Florence. Mm-hmm. He lives in Rome. This was an Italian state-run company which came up with this proposal to divert less than 5% of the water from the Congo River over to the Lake Chad Basin, and to stop the death of Lake Chad in the Sahel region, and to create irrigation, power, agriculture, and basically save an entire area of Africa which is dying. And there are a great number of immigrants in Italy and in Europe in general who are coming from that region here, and because they're desperate, they leave everything. You know, they leave everything and they go to look for a better life. So, but this is the kind of thing which used to be thought of, you know, in countries like Italy, Germany, France, and now there's no consideration whatsoever of something like this. In fact, this project was not carried out because they say there's no money. Mm-hmm. Of course, when it was time to, you know, to save the financial system, we came up with more than $10 trillion of loans and bailouts, but there's no money whatsoever for the actual infrastructure projects which are needed. So it is the same fight. I mean, the fight to dump the speculative part of the financial system and allow us to rebuild the real economy and make the investments we need is, you know, is the same thing.
Right. Do you want to add anything to that, Dave? Or no?
I think, you know, what we, in our work in trying to get across what Glass-Steagall is pedagogically, because, mm-hmm. you know, you do have a situation where you say, look, this is going to stop the bailouts, this will separate the commercial banking and the investment banking, and people have a sense of that and, you know, will, you know, say, yes, I support that and so forth, but what we've got to get to is this deeper point that what Glass-Steagall represents is an assertion of the constitutional principles. And, you know, if you look at the founding of the Constitution and the concept of a credit system, the two are synonymous. I mean, there's no way you could possibly separate the development of our credit policy with the development of our Constitution, including, you know, this reference of the general welfare in the preamble as also being in Article 1, Section 8, referring to how we actually have control over our finances. But that really, as LaRouche has outlined, that a credit system or a financial system or money is only there to serve the functions of the development of the physical economy. And that at higher modes of energy flux density in terms of your overall capabilities in your economy by the development of new technologies and of course requires the scientific base and as well the cultural base to do it as well, to have a population that can actually think to make these kind of creative breakthroughs. I think that's what in our organizing it's not just simply, oh, this is going to solve this banking mess, but
yeah.
Rather this is going to return us back to this constitutional outlook that there never should be a money system, or actually I'll put it in a different way, even the oligarchy knows that a financial system is a means to control the physical economy. In fact, that much of the economic warfare that they have waged on nations is they use a financial system to deny development to nations. Now, we've got to take it and say that the only reason for a financial system is for the development of nations, you know, along these creative scientific leaps, you know, new technologies and so forth. So yeah, that's why I'd just throw that in.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, one thing, you speak of the financial system being imposed to deny development, and then the mind control of such insane things as the Greenism, the mm-hmm. German government's official advisory report by this character Schellnhuber, mm-hmm. who I'm glad to say tried to get away with talking about genocide in Australia and ran right into the LaRouche movement there. you should see that on LaRouchePack.com. But in your respective parts of the world, we're talking about the world, but the United States, Italy, and Europe, nuclear power you just mentioned, Dave, but are you finding that the shutters are lifting, or the blinders, I meant, are in some people, are when you're getting into have an opportunity to engage people in starting to think again, that this starts to fall away?
Well, you know, to be honest, we're having a discussion around the fact that, you know, we are finding very wide openness
okay.
to Glass-Steagall per se, right?
Yes.
And that we now have to escalate it to the next level to get at these more the scientific conceptions behind Glass-Steagall.
Mm-hmm.
Because if Glass-Steagall were to have just gone through, but you didn't have the orientation that in terms of the physical economic recovery that would be needed, which is, of course, the nuclear and fission and pushing the limits of fusion, and then, of course, beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
If you were not going that direction, then really a Glass-Steagall banking reform would maybe just be a temporary fix, but not the longer-term orientation that we need to have, which is a culture oriented to scientific and technological advancement.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we need to take that to the next level. I will say, just related to that, much of what we're finding going into these various institutions, you know, say around the Democratic Party. Keep in mind that these are people who, for years, and you could go back decades, have had a closed-door policy to LaRouche, and some of it even more nasty, right? But
yeah.
I think what we're beginning to see is, you know, a lot of these meetings, we walk into these meetings, and for sure we're the youngest people around, and that many of these meetings are, you know, at some of the old 60s and older people that make up the bulk of the politically active in terms of the Democratic Party, and that going in as a younger generation saying very forcefully that we are on the edge of a collapse of civilization and that here is the way out, and just simply saying this is what you've got to do. You've got to move on Glass-Steagall. And we're seeing that people are moving just mm-hmm. by simply saying that, you know, this is the direction that we go, because at the very minimum, whatever their past disagreements are with us or so on, they recognize that this is the younger generation demanding that we have a future.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so there's an ability to move. Now, I do think we can actually take some of those people that are actually willing to, you know, move with us in one direction to sit down and have a more serious discussion that, look, the same axioms that have brought you to the brink of collapse in this financial system are the same axioms that have brought you to the brink of the collapse in the physical economy. And this greenism and environmentalism has got to go. So I think there we just have to do the next phase of the organizing, which is what comes in after Glass-Steagall.
Right. And you're speaking of constituting the voice of authority, and people are responding. Do you want to say anything, Andrew, especially about the fight in particular around nuclear power in Italy or not? I mean, it's...
Well, again, this is an important area where we need you in the sense that Italy has just undergone taken a big hit on this, because Italy is a country which in 1987 held a public, you know, popular referendum to ban nuclear power. Now, Italy's history actually is that in the 1950s and 60s, with a man named Enrico Mattei, Italy was at the forefront of developing civilian nuclear power. Mattei is a person who challenged the oil cartels. He ended up being assassinated for doing it. But he, despite being assassinated, he did much more for Italy than all the people around him who were too scared to do anything. And he led the economic development of Italy in the post-war period. And so Italy had four nuclear power plants. But after the Chernobyl, you know, accident, the Greenies immediately took the opportunity to organize a popular referendum with no serious debate whatsoever, of course, and people voted to ban nuclear power in Italy. So now Italy has the highest cost of electricity in all of Europe, and imports a significant amount of electricity. And the thing is that most of the electricity it imports comes from France or Switzerland, and is produced by nuclear power plants.
Mm-hmm.
So what has happened, though, over the past, you know, since then, the past 20 years, the population and especially the political institutions came around to the reality that Italy has to have nuclear power. Now, unfortunately, after Japan, what happened is that the massive propaganda machine was put into motion, and there was another referendum held in Italy, and once again, people voted to ban nuclear power, to stop the government from going forward with nuclear power. And this is, you know, the kind of situation where there is a lack of technological optimism in the population. And, you know, as an American, I see this very clearly, this difference very clearly in Europe and in the United States. And I want to emphasize and stress this for the U.S. citizens who are listening. So you have the notion that we can, you know, we as human beings or as a nation can use technology, can use new ideas, you know, technology based on creative thinking and science to solve problems, right, is a characteristic of the identity of the United States of America in its history. And the key part is the ability to actually carry that out and implement that, because that's what people recognize in the history of the United States as the positive role of the United States. And what they're unable here to get past is this block, this idea that, well, we can't do it. You know, if things are all good, and then so when you're organized people, they have this, they say, well, gee, that's really great. And people tend to be smart. They get the point when you're talking about the economics, you're talking about the economic development. They get the point, and they say, well, that's great, but we can't do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's not a sense of actually being able to get things done. And that's why, again, this is so key that what happens in the United States is very key for what happens over here in Europe, because there is a collective psychosis has been imposed on the population, you know, in the aftermath of the tsunami in Japan, where, you know, just to repeat it, the tsunami killed, you know, 23,000, 25,000 people, and the nuclear accident killed zero people. So, but if you read the newspapers here, the media, they'll tell you that the nuclear disaster killed 20,000 people, is the way they essentially put it. So we have a, there are excellent technological capabilities, engineering capabilities here, which can be unleashed and must be unleashed, and that can be done, you know, through the reorganization of the financial system. But it will require the type of cultural optimism, you know, and scientific orientation, creative orientation, that is typified by the history of the United States of America.
Right. And, well, let me reiterate, you will know that you're listening to The LaRouche Show. This is July 16, the July 16 program for Saturday, 2011. And we're in our closing minutes. We have a few, however, and let me go to one thing. I'll repeat that July 21st, 2011, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Mr. LaRouche will be having an international webcast. It's based in Washington, D.C. vicinity, and you can find that on LaRouchePack.com. But be sure and spread the word, and also be sure to tune in and to what we've mentioned several times is Mr. LaRouche's interview. It's just about 15 minutes that's on LaRouchePack now that was taped just taped July 14. Now, I'm just back to you, Dave. Again, I was watching at the time in May one of your interview you did at a time of street organizing in Seattle. But you really hit it to people that you have to make the Glass-Steagall do-or-die fight a matter of talk at the dinner table. You can't segregate it or compartmentalize it in any way. And I think that you've described, reminded people that you had some prior orientation of your congressional delegation, your lawmakers, to the Glass-Steagall fight because, of course, Maria Cantwell had sponsored it in the Senate with some other senators. And then the whole Dodd-Frank thing came down and to smash this. But there were congressmen who went along with it because they were chicken and they went along with the smashing of Glass-Steagall at the time. Mm-hmm. They were chicken, and also they were so chicken and other directed they didn't want to be associated with the way LaRouche would be a rising star because he had always supported Glass-Steagall. So let's not get into their pathology, but you may want to encourage people that now's the time to even if you've supported this passively, to now activate, give money, enlist people, pressure like never before, release statements, whatever you want, whatever you advise.
Yeah, well, I do think, in some of the people that have mobilized with us, and I'll put it another way, which is that you do have from some of the older crowd, you know, baby boomer generation, people that are sitting there unable to act on their own, but a younger generation comes along and says, you know, as LaRouche has identified, this is the generation that fights the wars. And with a younger generation that sees absolutely no future to say, look, you got to get up and you got to move. And so we are seeing people that are moving and, in that sense, moving as sovereign individuals just with a healthy kick in the ass from some of the younger crowd. But, you know, some of the guys that have moved with us, they've had discussions with the congressmen themselves who have said, well, look, it's, you know, I agree, we do need Glass-Steagall, and, you know, I notice what you guys are doing, but it's not the time. In fact, one of the congressmen saying that we might have to wait till after the election to 2012 until we can get some Democrats in there. So, again, reflecting this club mentality, but it's just very clear that what the national slate has done and it continues to do is to say, we know what the time frame is. We're already past the, you know, we've got to move now to get this thing through now. We're not going to play these games that we have endless time to just wait around and get all the what we think are the right forces together, but rather say, look, we're recruiting people to get out of their clubs, to get in as, you know, bipartisan or really nonpartisan and say, what are our constitutional principles and let's mobilize. And that's what the slate is doing nationally.
Right. Well, in the final minute of all, And again, I stress LaRouche's July 21st webcast. But Andrew, you were at this conference, and part of your theme, that is, that was the Schiller Institute conference I invite everyone to see, especially the concert and so forth on LaRouchePack.com. LaRouche Online, EIR Online, our LaRouchePub.com publication, has its latest issue on this conference. But you want to say the final words about there's grounds for cultural optimism.
Well, there are grounds for optimism, and in particular because what we saw at this conference was people from various countries around Europe, from various sectors of the of the population, mayors of small towns, milk producers, people who work in finance, and then normal citizens who are supporters of the movement. We brought together the type of people who made it clear that there is no, there's no alternative to making this change right now, and they recognize that. People who otherwise only worry about their own, their own problem, but now have decided that there's been no alternative to linking that to the larger problem. And we have, what was presented at this event was very clearly, the policies which need to be implemented and then the conceptual basis for these policies. We have a moment of opportunity now to do this because, especially the view from Europe is this system here, the Euro system, is coming down, and it's very clear, that it's a complete failure. Now it's time to do something new, and we can do that together with the United States for a Glass-Steagall system.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much. We are out of time. It has been the July 16th, 2011 LaRouche Show. I thank Andrew Spanas in Italy and Dave Christie in Seattle. This is Marcia Mary Baker signing off. Thank you very much.